Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the subject of property when we come back. And let me ask you this. What do you think is wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it's pretty obvious that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools. They're banned from our public institutions. They're banned from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place, and they're teaching these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our schools, public institutions, and we've made them a part of our national psyche. You know, this is a pretty radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years. Are you aware, for instance, that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but your daughter can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent? Now, that's why I contend that the solution to this kind of moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still at least one school left in America that teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the 33 benefits for their observance. You know, every law has a penalty. And you don't have to know what the penalty to the law is in order to suffer from its effects. So whether we call this the Mosaic Law, the law of God, the common law, or natural law, or karma, or something else, it's automatic. And it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happened to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, why don't you go to our website, georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page, and then you can download that free general law CD package right there off of the archives page at georgegordon.org. All right, we've been talking about this thing of property and property rights, and now it's gotten over into a thing called adhesion contracts. These adhesion contracts are a source of the alienation of you and I from our property rights. And the government comes along. It doesn't just have to be government. It can be insurance companies and pharmaceuticals or employers or somebody else. But primarily, our government comes to us and they have us sign up and join various licensing schemes and programs which alienate us from our constitutional rights and place us under contract. And then they create these contractual obligations and then they prosecute us and punish us, take our property, take our money, take our lives, our liberties, and our properties. And they do it without our consent and without our knowledge. And I contend that that's wrong. That you should be informed as to the terms and agreement of the contract that you're entering into. So let me tell you a little story here. I had an old buddy of mine. His name was Peter, and he lived in Bellwood Estates in Boise, Idaho. And one day he looked out his dining room window, and he saw the neighbor across the street re-roofing his house. And they had a roofing contractor out there, and they were putting on asphalt shingles. And now, my friend Peter, he didn't have asphalt shingles on his house. He had wood shingles, or shakes, as they call them. And all of the houses in the neighborhood had these wood shakes. Now, the wood shakes on there cost about four times more money. And the objective, of course, for putting a roof on your house is to keep the rain out. Now, in this particular community, they had what was known as restrictive covenants. And one of the restrictive covenants was that the neighborhood committee, of which Peter now was a member, and they elected these members, you know, the committee would be a democratically elected group of homeowners in the committee, or in the community, and he as one of the members said, wait a minute, you can't put these asphalt shingles on your house, it has to be wood shakes. And so here's the guy putting on these asphalt shingles, and so he called a meeting, and then he pointed this out to the rest of the members that, hey, wait a minute, under the restrictive covenant, you cannot put anything but these shakes on your house. And so they called this guy in, and they said, now, you take those asphalt shingles off of your house, and you put shakes on there. We are going to dictate, we're going to tell you that you can't do that. Now, it's going to cost this guy four times as much money, and you might sit there and say, well, now, whose business is this? I mean, just picture this. You want to put a roof on your house, and your neighbors, democratically elected, come to you and say, you can't do that. Now, there's one part of the story. Now, I want you to think about that one for a minute. How does this democratically elected committee get the power to come to you and tell you that you cannot put those kinds of shingles on your house? They had another rule in there. There was another guy prior to that wanted to paint his house, and it was kind of a, yeah, it wasn't purple, but it was kind of that color, you know. It wasn't a bright purple or anything, but anyway, this guy's painting his house, and I said, wait a minute, hang on. They came to that guy, and they said, you cannot paint your house purple. That's what they were calling it, actually. It was some kind of a light purple. It was a, you know, some kind of a blend of colors. I couldn't tell you exactly what the color was, but purple was kind of the shade of it. Because the restrictive covenant in the community, this is Bellwood Estates, now they said, no, wait a minute. You can only paint your house white or beige. They had two colors. All of the houses in Bellwood Estates were painted beige or white. And this guy now is painting his color, his house with some kind of a color that was off-white, or, you know, it was kind of a purple color and so on. And so they came to him and said, no, you're not going to do this. And if you continue on, we're going to sue you. We're going to take you into court. What do you think of that? Now, here's the distinction in that case. All of the people in that community, when they buy in there, buy in under what's known as a restrictive covenant. And that restrictive covenant has a set of rules or a set of guidelines that is agreed to by the people or by the contractor when he builds the community. They're called gated community. And the in both of these cases, the people who are being put upon, that is the guy with the roof and the guy with the paint color, they voted for these people. And, you know, from time to time, they may have actually sat on the committee themselves, the homeowners committee. So this is a contractual agreement by the number of homeowners that live in this community, and they all agree among themselves. They write up an agreement, and they say, we agree that we will all paint our houses white or beige, and we will not paint any other color, and we won't allow anybody else to. And you agree that we can sue you if you paint your house some other color, and we all agree we're going to use wooden shakes on our house, and if you use anything else other than those wooden shakes, you agree that we can sue you and that you won't do that. Now, there's a big difference there. That's not an adhesion contract. That's an express contract. Somebody, when they sold you that house, they did not deceive you by telling you that there were no restrictive covenants. Everybody who buys a house there is furnished with the restrictive covenants. Everybody knows what the rules of the game are going in. And you agreed to that when you bought this place. Just like you do when you buy a house, you know what the property taxes are on the day that you buy the house. So you're not deceived. You know that there's a bill that's going to come every year and that you're going to have to pay that. If, in fact, you were lied to and somebody said, well, the property tax over here is $500 and you come back later and you find out, no, it's $1,000. All right, now that's a fraud. Somebody lied to you about that and deceived you. Nobody deceived these guys in this case. That's called express. Now, when we're talking about an adhesion contract, we're talking about a surprise. We're talking about something that you had no idea. No reasonable person would have ever suspected such a thing. And these are contracts implied in law. The contract, which is implied in law, is but a duty imposed by law and treated as a contract for the purposes of a remedy. So we've got a law, and then, you know, let's call this law, you shall do no murder, thou shalt not commit adultery. Then you've got a law that says, buckle your seatbelt and drive on the right side of the road. One of them is a law, and the other is a contract which is implied in law, an implied contract. Let me show you how that works. An example of a duty imposed by law would be a marriage license, building permit, or a driver's license, such as you shall not exceed 55 miles an hour, or any statute requiring some specific performance. Contracts that are implied in law implies a promise to pay, whether or not any promise was made or intended. So when an individual fails to perform, that creates a quasi-breach of contract. As the corporate state demands, there must be a remedy. A remedy is a penalty, a promise to pay, paid to the state, which is determined by the state chancellor and is provided for in the contractual statute. And since there is an implied contract, such as a license, then intent need not be proven. Now, when we have a crime, crime has two elements. There has to be an act, and there has to be intent. Act with intent equals crime. If I come to you and I say, well, we need a kingdom. Well, a kingdom over here has to have four elements. You have to have a king, land, subjects, and law. Otherwise, you don't have a kingdom. When we're talking about contract, you have to have an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. So there's four elements. When you have a crime, you have to have these two elements, act with intent. When you have an adhesion contract, all you need is the act. You don't need any intent. Now, a promise implied in law is one in which neither the words nor the conduct of the party involved are promissory in form or justify an inference of any promise, and the term is used to indicate that a party is under a legally enforceable duty, as he would have been if he, in fact, had made such a promise. So we've got a promise implied in law, which is enforceable, even though you never made any such promise and never even knew that such a promise had been implied in law. Now, we have a thing here called quasi or constructive contracts. Now, a contract implied in law is, however, a term used to cover a class of obligations where the law, though the defendant did not intend to assume any obligation, this law imposes an obligation upon him, notwithstanding the absence of the intention on his part, and in many cases, in spite of his actual dissent. How do you like that? I mean, you could actually dissent from this particular contract or quasi-contract or law, and it would still be imposed upon you. Such contracts may be termed quasi-contracts. Now, they're not true contracts, and they're founded generally upon statutory or official or customary duties, so says Bouvier's Law Dictionary. Quasi-contracts are only found in the civil law, and they're defined as an obligation similar in character to that of a contract, but which arises not from an agreement of parties, but from some relation between them or from a voluntary act from one of them. Now, could there be a relationship between the state and the individual? Notice that it only requires the voluntary act of one of the parties. The voluntary act of one may well be the act of the state passing statutory legislation. Quasi-contracts were a well-defined class under the civil law. By the Civil Code of Louisiana, for instance, they're defined to be the lawful and purely voluntary acts of man, from which there results any obligation whatever to a third person and sometimes a reciprocal obligation between parties. In quasi-contracts, the obligation arises not from consent, as in the case of contracts, but it arises from the law or natural equity. Now, it is not unlawful to perform the act, but if you do, there is an obligation, there is a penalty clause, requiring a remedy, some kind of a payment. All right, so let's try it. You're driving down the road, and the state now imposes a speed limit of 55 miles an hour, and you drive 65. You're not harming anybody. You haven't caused any accidents. You haven't done anything to anybody else. You may be the only guy on the road. But the state's agent, the highway patrolman, sees that you're driving 65, so he stops you in the name of the health, safety, and welfare of the state under the police power, and he issues you a citation and says, you have broken the law. And while you haven't caused anybody any damage, which under a contract you'd have to cause a damage to trigger the penal clause to the contract, and furthermore, you didn't know, for instance, that the speed limit was 65, or 55. You didn't see the sign, hadn't caused anybody any damage, but the state expects you to pay a penalty because of this breach of the contract. You may not have even agreed with the terms and conditions. So this is a contract which we call an extraordinary contract. You've got a contract here, son, but it's an extraordinary contract. The lawful acts of an individual then become a quasi-breach of contract. Notice that the obligation arises from the law of natural equity. It doesn't arise from the common law, an important element here. The common law requires that there be a damage to somebody's life, liberty, or property before you can have an action. Now, under the civil law, under quasi-contract, under adhesion contracts, you don't have to cause anybody a damage. The guy that's putting the roof on the house isn't causing a damage to anybody else in the neighborhood. The guy who wants to paint his house isn't causing anybody else a damage. The reason that we have these restrictive covenants is because everybody in the community knows that shakes on the house make the house more valuable. It affects the property value of that house, and the property value of that house reflects upon the property values of every other house in the neighborhood. This is why people want restrictive covenants. In other words, they want zoning and planning, they want it voluntarily, they want it done under contract, and because they don't want the neighbor to put in a pig farm next door. This is why we want zoning and planning. We want it because it's going to affect my property values. Now, what this does, it takes away from the people who want to paint their house some other color the freedom of choice. All right, now let's apply that. In a restricted, gated community, everybody knows what the terms and conditions are, and they agree to it going in. That's a contract. An adhesion contract is where you're living in the community and zoning and planning comes in and says XYZ. You can or cannot paint your house this color. You didn't agree to it. It was never presented to you. And in fact, that rule or regulation, custom, usage, or practice may have been imposed after you bought the house. Now that's the fundamental difference. In an express contract, you know the terms and conditions, or as we say in law, he knew or he should have known. Boys and girls, there isn't any reason for you to know, and there isn't any reason why you should know what the Zoning and Planning Commission enacted in their private session last month or last year. You aren't even supposed to know, and they don't broadcast it and they don't publish it. They put it in the policy, they put it in the regulations, and you're bound by it. And when you come down and apply for a building permit, they're going to enforce it. And they're going to enforce it on everybody. And listen, zoning and planning in your city, they can come up with regulations and say, you cannot put this kind of a roof on your house, and you cannot paint your house that color. And that's what I'm contending is wrong. Adhesion contracts, they're lawful, they're legal, they've been around for thousands of years. And you ought to know what these terms and conditions in these adhesion contracts are and how you can find out to inform yourself. Are you really sure that you want to buy in this neighborhood? Are you really sure that you want to submit yourself to these terms and conditions that you didn't know anything about? Now, I explained that the other day with a warranty clause. When you fill out that warranty card, all you see is the card, and all you know is that it's a guarantee in case the toaster breaks. What you don't know is that there is a contract filed with the Secretary of State in a foreign state that precludes you suing the company for some misdeed under the common law that they should be liable for, such as wrongful death, but you are agreeing to let them escape from any penalty. And you don't know that you're letting them escape. You don't know that you're giving them a waiver for the possibility of wrongful death. Hang on a second. Shouldn't you have full disclosure? Shouldn't you know what it is you're agreeing to? Well, now, those of us who are trained in the law, we know that. I don't fill out warranty cards. But don't you think that people who have never been trained in the law also ought to be informed? Now, according to Professor Ames, the term was not found in the common law, but it has been taken by writers of the common law from the Roman law. It need only be added here that quasi-contracts were in the Roman law of almost infinite variety, but they were divided into five classes. And the management of the affairs of another without authority is what it boils down to. When we deal with quasi-contracts, we are giving over to somebody else the management of our affairs, and we're doing it without giving them our authority. Now, that's about as clear a definition of deception or fraud as you can get. Now, from the point of view of the sovereign individual, what has happened here is that there has been a breach of contract with his government. Government has usurped the common law. That's the Ten Commandment model. And they have replaced that Ten Commandment model with a form of the Roman civil law, the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. And now, as a result, government is constantly managing your affairs without your authority. Constructive quasi-contracts are pure fictions of law. They are not contracts. They presume a performance of duty without regard to the assent of both parties. Constructive quasi-contracts are created by statute on the premise that they're needed as a matter of reason and justice, and they're allowed to be enforced ex contractu. Now, it should be noted that ex contractu is a term from the civil law in contradistinction to ex delicto from the common law. Ex contractu is a form of action under the civil law, whereas under the common law it would arise from actions of case, replevin, trespass, or trover. Ex contractu actions are from the civil law. They are not from the common law, and they are enforced by actions in personam. Constructive quasi-contracts are based solely upon a legal fiction or a fiction of law. Let me demonstrate a typical fiction of law. Let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion, that I'm sitting here at my desk and an officer comes in, a military man, and he comes into the classroom here, and he says, I'm looking for George Gordon. And I raise my hand and I say, well, I'm George Gordon. He says, well, Mr. Gordon, you're under arrest. And the charge is you are in violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington. Come with me, please. Now, we need to ask ourselves a couple, three things here. Where does this guy get the power and the authority to come in here and make this arrest? Well, it's called the police power. Governments have this police power. We give it to them so that we can maintain law and order. When a soldier is absent without leave, he is in violation of the terms and conditions of his enlistment contract. And the Uniform Code of Military Justice is predicated upon the voluntary enlistment or the voluntary contract of the parties. So the military service hasn't created a an adhesion contract. The terms and conditions of the military enlistment are pretty plain and straightforward. You were under the Constitution and the laws of your state, and you voluntarily waived those rights, joined the military, and now you're under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So when this MP arrests me and takes me out of here, is he going to take me to a grand jury? Is he going to take me to Springfield and arraign me before a federal district magistrate? No, sir. He's going to load me up and haul me off to Fort Lewis, Washington. And then the provost marshal out there, when they bring me into my arraignment, they're going to say, Sergeant Gordon, you're charged with a violation of the UCMJ Section 22404 in that you're absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington. How do you plead to the charge? And then he wants me to plead guilty or not guilty. Now watch what happens. If I plead guilty, then I admit that I'm a soldier who's absent without leave in breach of contract, and I'm throwing myself on the mercy of the court, and I'm suggesting that they go ahead and execute the punishment. If I plead not guilty, I admit that I'm a soldier, but I deny that I'm absent without leave, and I set a question of fact before the court, was he or was he not absent, and did he or did he not have a Liberty card? But what if I'm a civilian and I don't have a contract with the Army? And the MP comes in and he says, now you're under arrest, and I walk into the military court and I plead not guilty. Well, when I walk into the military court as a civilian and plead not guilty, from that point on, I cannot win. I am going to be convicted. And that's what happens to all of us. When we walk into this court under this quasi-contract, from that point on, whether you plead guilty or not guilty, you cannot win. End of report. And the reason is you have just pled into a fiction of law. And the fiction of law is this. You are a soldier in the Army. Now, the factual issue is, are you a soldier in the Army? And when you plead not guilty, you admit that you're a soldier in the Army. You don't have to stand up there and say, I am a soldier in the Army. We presume you're a soldier in the Army when the judge asks you the question, how do you plead? Because if you were a civilian, you wouldn't plead, you would demur. So the minute you plead, then you're agreeing with the prosecutor that you're a soldier. The second issue, are you absent from Fort Lewis, Washington? Well, of course I'm absent from Fort Lewis, Washington. I'm in Isabella, Missouri. Now, there is a factual question as to whether or not I have a Liberty card. But if I'm a civilian and I'm living in Isabella, Missouri, and I'm not at Fort Lewis, Washington, then it's pretty obvious, and I would even stipulate to the fact that I don't have anybody's permission from Fort Lewis, Washington to be here in Isabella, Missouri today. So when I plead not guilty, the issue before the court is, does he have a Liberty card and is he a soldier? He pled not guilty, so he admitted to being a soldier. He doesn't have a Liberty card, so therefore he's absent without leave, and that's the only issue that's going to be brought up. Now, if I'm in trial and I stand up and I say, I want to tell the court I'm not a soldier in the Army, the prosecutor is going to jump up and yell, objection, it goes beyond the scope of the pleadings, and the judge is going to sustain his objection and then admonish me that if there's any more outbursts from me, he's going to hold me in contempt. You see, by the time we get to trial, the issue of whether or not I'm a soldier is not on the table. The pleadings are now concluded. And now that the pleadings are concluded, we're only here to decide, were you or were you not absent from Fort Lewis, and did you or did you not have a Liberty card? Those two factual questions are already settled. I was found in Isabella, Missouri, and had nobody's permission to be there. And you might say, well, that's a miscarriage of justice. No, it isn't. It's a mistake in pleading, not a miscarriage of justice. Hang on, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and all that can be accessed through our website. It's georgegordon.org. And again, that's georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. 67. Now, if you're online, you can go to our webpage, georgegordon.org, click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors and publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be, they don't have to be, but they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, we invite you to go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about property and property rights. Now, the subject of property, not the property itself, but rather the subject, not the rocks, the minerals, or the earth, but it's the use of the property. Now, in the case of the man who cannot paint his house purple, or the man who cannot put on the shingles of his desire, is not being put upon. He has an express contract in which he agreed that he would not paint his house this ghastly color. And he has not agreed, or I mean he has agreed rather, that he will not put on any other kind of shingles other than those prescribed in the agreement. Now, let me tell you a little story here. One time I was running a business there in Boise, Idaho, and I had a building down at 412 South 9th Street, and it was a big warehouse. And I was off of the main drag. It was kind of down in the warehouse district, but Front Street was about three blocks up. And when you were driving down Front Street, you could see my building for about, oh, maybe a quarter of a mile. And I said to myself, I need to paint my building a color. I need to paint my building in such a way that it will attract people's attention so that they can see it. So I elected to paint my building caterpillar yellow. That's right, caterpillar yellow. Now, right across the street from me, there was a building, a furniture company. Now, I was in the furniture business, and there was a furniture there called a furniture store called Foster's Warehouse Furniture. And it was run by a very sweet lady, very, very dear person, and I don't want to run her down in any way, and her daughter, Bonnie. And they were very conservative people, and they had this big three or four, maybe even five-story tall building, warehouse building, called Foster's Warehouse Furniture. Very successful furniture store. Everything's going along fine. But they were very prominent, and you could see their building. And they were well known. And then here was little Georgie Gordon. You know, who knows about little Georgie's furniture store? So I needed to attract attention. You know, sometimes you'll see car dealers. They'll put searchlights out and put up balloons and things like that. They're trying to draw your attention to their car lot. And that's what I needed to do. So I hired a contractor. And as I recall, I paid him $15,000 to paint my building. And he's out there with his crew, and they're out there just spraying, you know, caterpillar yellow paint all over my building. And I was standing out in the parking lot admiring of the building being painted, and Bonnie came over, Mrs. Foster, and she engaged me in conversation there in the parking lot, and she said, I see you're painting your building, and she said, isn't that a terribly garish color? I like that word, garish, G-A-R-I-S-H, a garish color. And I said, no, it's not garish, it's yellow, caterpillar yellow. She didn't appreciate the humor at all. And then she said, you know, we are trying to establish down here in the warehouse district an air of respectability. We are trying to create an atmosphere. And she said, if you paint this building yellow, it's going to destroy the atmosphere of our building. And she showed her building, which was done in, you know, gray and brown. And her building looked wonderful. I don't deny that. I always admired Foster's Warehouse Furniture. And then she pointed across the alley, and she said, well, what about the Cedars restaurant over there? And I looked over at the Cedars, and they had a wonderful building over there. It was brick down in the warehouse district. It used to be an old pharmaceutical supply house, and they put a restaurant in there. I thought, you know, that's a heck of a neat deal. And so I looked at her, and I said, now, Mrs. Foster, are you offended by this color? And she said, yes, I am terribly offended by that color. And so I apologized, and I said, well, listen, I'm terribly sorry that you're offended by that color. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. If you don't like that color, you go over there to that man in that pickup and you tell him, I don't like that color, and I want you to stop right now, and then you tell him what color you want this building painted. And then you pay that contractor for stopping the painting operation right here, and you pay that contractor for whatever color you want to put on here. And that's where the conversation ended. And she left. She did not go over to the contractor. She did not tell him to stop painting. And she did not tell him what color she wanted painting, and she did not pay for the paint job. And right away, that told me how important that color was to her. Now, as long as she could come over and dictate to me and tell me what color she wanted on there, and I'm paying for it, she had a color scheme. But when it came to her painting my building and paying for it, oh no, she didn't want to do that. Now, when we're talking about these adhesion contracts over here, we want the committee, we want as voters, to be able to tell the other people over there what colors they should be painting their buildings and what kind of shingles they should be putting on them. But if you and I have to pay for that, then all of a sudden it's not very important. And that's the difference between the 10 planks and the 10 commandments. That's the difference between individual responsibility and collectivism, the collective. Now, a debt resulting from a normal agreement or contract has always been the result of a promise to pay and invoked a remedy in the form of a sumpsit. Now, an sumpsit cannot be applied to actions of debts where there is no agreement unless the court does so by means of a fiction, because in order to support a sumpsit, it's necessary to allege a promise, and without agreement, there is no promise. Historically, the courts have adopted the fiction of a promise, and it was declared that a promise was implied in law. And what this amounts to is that for the convenience of the remedy, they have been made to figure as though they sprung from contract and have appropriated the form of agreement. Now, any obligation created by law, implied by law, or quasi-contract is not only unscientific and therefore theoretically wrong, but it is also destructive of clear thinking, and therefore it's vicious in its practice. It needs no argument to establish the proposition that it is not scientific to treat as one and the same thing an obligation that exists in every case because of the assent of the defendant, and an obligation that not only does not depend in any case upon his assent, but in many cases exists notwithstanding his assent and maybe even his dissent. Or put another way, I'm sure that in the community, had there been a committee in the warehouse district of the various owners, they would have come over and voted against my paint color. Little doubt in my mind. But you know, the decision, the freedom that we like to brag about here in America and Canada and the Western world comes from individual free choice. And the choices that other individuals make will not necessarily be the kinds of choices that you would make. But that's what freedom's all about, isn't it? You know, freedom of speech, for instance, is the freedom to allow somebody else to express himself in his own way, probably in opposition to you. And in compensation for that, he shuts up, and then you can speak, and then you can express yourself. Those are reciprocal. Well, then shouldn't that also apply to paint? Now, in this case, it did, because we didn't have any committee. What we're still using is the common law and the right of choice and the freedom to make choices. You know, when we go into Subway and we want to order a sandwich, how would you like a committee to decide what kind of sandwich you're going to eat today? And the committee could be well-intended. We could have a health committee in every Subway restaurant. You come into Subway and you say, hey, I want that salami on cheese. And the committee says, no, you're way overweight. That's going to add to your cholesterol. That's going to add to your high blood pressure. No, you cannot have that kind of a sandwich. Here is what you can eat. Now, you might sit there and say, well, my God, nobody would do such a thing. Hey, we've already got that. We've already got that. Listen to this. I was working one time in a Circle K store, and they used to take WIC, W-I-C, I don't know what that stands for, you know, the women in need of community or whatever, but it was some kind of a welfare program. And one day we got a policy or a legal order. I don't know whether it was a company policy or I think it was probably from the Department of Social Services. And it said, here's a list of foods that you cannot sell to people by using this WIC coupon. In other words, it was already there that if somebody on WIC or food stamps or something came in, they couldn't buy cigarettes, they couldn't buy beer, couldn't buy, you know, soda pop. But the WIC people, they went a step further. In fact, they even sent Social Lady out to the WIC recipients. And they would open their cabinets and look inside, and if they found food in there that didn't meet the WIC standards, didn't have the right kind of vitamins and minerals or had too much sugar or salt or whatever, they would cut off those WIC funds from the recipient. Now, you might say, well, that's some kind of tyranny. No, no, that's not at all. You see, when you go in to sign up for WIC, they tell you right up front, if you want this benefit from us, then we're going to set down the rules for you. Let me give you an illustration. Let's suppose you come over here to my house, and you say to me, hey, I'm hungry, Mr. Gordon, would you feed me? And I say, well, yeah, I'll feed you. And then I put out some food in front of you, and you say, now, wait a minute, Mr. Gordon, I'm hungry, and I want you to feed me, and I appreciate you doing that for me, but I don't like this kind of food, and I don't want it. And I want you to provide for me the kind of food that I want to eat, and then you give me a list of what it is that you want to eat. And there's an old adage that says, beggars can't be choosers. Now, if you want to eat shrimp cocktail, I don't have any objection to that, but I'm not going to furnish that to you. I mean, that's where reality's at. Now, if you want pinto beans and cornbread, you know, I'd be happy to share that with you. But if you're coming in here telling me you want oysters Rockefeller on my nickel, you know, you're going to have to go someplace else and provide for yourself. And that's all WIC is telling those people. They're saying, hey, listen, this is the way this has to be done because, you know, you're the one that's asking us. And that's a contract. And when you sign up for those welfare benefits, you're signing away your choices. You're signing away your rights. And you have a choice to make. And that's what I'm suggesting. I like choices. I chose yellow for my building. And I gave the one person who complained about the color that I chose a very pragmatic option. If you don't like that color, Bonnie, you can paint that building any color you want as long as you pay for it. And I tell you the same thing. You can have anything you want to eat there, son, as long as you pay for it. I remember one time a guy took me to lunch down in New Orleans. We went to Antoine's. Now, Antoine's is a restaurant, pretty fancy restaurant, although when I got in there and looked around, I didn't think it was all that fancy. They just had oilcloth on the tables. But it was the place to eat, and they don't have any prices on the menu. I guess the theory down there is that if there has to be prices on the menu, or if you have to have the prices on the menu, you can't afford to eat here. Well, my host, he ate oysters Rockefeller, and I don't know, I guess I had a cheeseburger and fries or something. I don't know what I ate, but the bill was $140 for lunch. Boy, I'm glad he was buying. I didn't know what the hell I was eating, and I didn't know what the price was going to be, and he didn't care. He has the money. But the moral to the story is a menu in a restaurant is a contract. That's what that is. It's an offer. The guy comes up to you, hands you the menu, says, here's our offer. When you give him the order, that's the acceptance. The time is the amount of time it takes to cook it. And the consideration is the price that he published on that menu. When there's no price on the menu, that's not a contract. Got that? Antoine's is not contracting with anybody. And it doesn't make any difference when the bill comes if it's $140 or $1,440. Got that? There's no contract. Now, you came in there and you took his property. And if you eat his property and you don't meet his terms over there, that's a theft, pure and simple. Now, I don't like those kinds of open-ended deals. I don't want to participate in that kind of a program. That's why I don't like adhesion contracts in New Orleans. And Louisiana is a civil law state. It's the only one here in the United States that's a civil law state. All the rest of us are common law states that have been converted by adhesion contract into communist states under the old Roman civil law. I'm opposed to that. I think that everybody should have an opportunity to see what the hell the price is so that we're all operating on the same page. And when General Electric puts a warranty card into your toaster box and you fill that out, son, you're making a contract and agreeing to terms and conditions that you have no idea even where they're located, much less what the terms and conditions are. But let's suppose for the sake of our discussion that the toaster kills you. You plug it in, kills you dead. And your wife sues General Electric for wrongful death. The case goes to trial and General Electric comes in and they present as their side of the case the contract, just like George Rapp did. And do you know how the court's going to rule? They're going to say, well, here's what happens. You knew or should have known that there was an exemption in the contract, and it says you cannot sue General Electric for wrongful death, that you waive that common law remedy. And you accept the remedy that General Electric has proposed, and that is, we agree that in the event that this toaster kills you, we will repair or replace the toaster at our option. I think you should be aware of that, and that's why I'm telling you this story. Now, fortunately, in order for a quasi-contract to attach, a benefit must be conferred on the defendant by the plaintiff. The defendant must have displayed an appreciation for that benefit and accept and retain that benefit so that it is inequitable for him to retain the benefit without payment for the value of that benefit. Now, a person confers a benefit upon another as respects liability in quasi-contracts for restitution if he gives to another possession of or some other interest in money, land, chattels, chooses an action, performs services beneficial to or at the request of the other, or in any other way adds to the other security or advantage. And he confers a benefit not only where he adds to the property of another, but also where he saves the other from expense or loss. You see what Social Security does? The government takes your money, confers the benefit upon you, gains your power of attorney, and controls you totally. Takes all of your labor for all of your life with your consent. But they never told you when you gave that consent, and you probably couldn't find it at high noon with both hands and a roadmap, but there it is. Now, as always, the bottom line is, what are these benefits, and to whom do these benefits attach? A liability or an obligation, and does a person driving on the road without a license do so at the privilege of the state and therefore in receipt of some benefit? A natural person can only be held accountable for substantive crimes, that is, crimes where there is a loss or damage of life, liberty, or property to somebody else under the provisions of the common law. Obviously, corporate activities and other juristic persons all receive a benefit from the state, and they have the obligation to pay the penalty for breaching the contract. But natural persons, individuals functioning as a matter of right, receive no benefit from the state. Remember Hale versus Hinkle? And therefore, he is not subject to the penalty for not specifically performing. The natural person, the individual, is not created by the state and cannot commit any crime where there is no loss or damage to somebody's life, liberty, or property. So what that means then is that the natural person can only be charged with common law crimes unless he has consented or volunteered into a contract, corporate charter, or some other licensing scheme. And that's where Social Security, driver's license, marriage license, and adhesion contract shine, because that's precisely the vehicle that government and industry, insurance, medicine, they come in with these adhesion contracts and sign you up, and they tell you that this national health care insurance, for instance, is for health care. That's an adhesion contract administered by the IRS. Nothing more, nothing less. Hey, I'm out of time, boys and girls. We're going to have to leave it right there. Let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Well, that's it. We're out of time. I'm going to have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.